I'm Peggy Waymeyer with the World Vision Report. In California, illegal immigrants worry about paying off the smugglers who got them here.
There are some days I can't sleep. I'm tossing and turning in bed with the stress that I get from thinking about this, about the debt, about my family. If I did not pay the money, they said that they were going to kidnap one of my children.
Going home in South Sudan, former child soldiers trade their AK-47s for soccer balls. And a school for untouchables in India keeps an ancient style of music alive.
My father told me, I tell my children, he tell his children. So all 38 generations learned by that way.
38 generations. That's an oral tradition reaching back 2,000 years.
Around the world with the World Vision Report. First, this news. This is the World Vision Report. I'm Peggy Waymeyer. Arizona's new immigration law has focused attention on immigration once again. Since debate on the controversial law began, there have been reports of immigrants leaving the state and going back home. The same thing's happening in California, but there, it's because people are having a hard time finding jobs in this recession. Daisha Eaton reports.
About 30 men stand on a street corner in the MacArthur Park neighborhood of L.A. It's safe to assume they're all illegal immigrants, and they're all hoping to get work on this early morning from people passing by on their way to a nearby Home Depot. The smell of chuleta, grilled pork chops smothered in tomatillo sauce, fills the air as street vendors bargain with workers over the price of the hearty breakfast. Javier, a short, stocky man with Mayan features and a pockmarked face, finishes his meal and tells me a familiar story. He came here from Guatemala 3 years ago to work in construction, but thanks to the recession, he spends more time pacing the pavement than pounding nails and hanging drywall.
Well, when I came here, I was able to work. I felt really good. But then, later, life started to get harder because I wasn't able to find work anymore.
Many illegal immigrants here are in the same boat.
Sometimes we get really desperate and we want to go back to our country. But with this debt that we have, where are we going to go?
The debt Javier is referring to are loans that some Guatemalans take out from lenders in their home country. They use the money to pay men called coyotes who are willing to smuggle them across the border. The lender holds the deed to their property as collateral. Javier took a loan out for $5,500. But 3 years later, because of high interest, 10%, and little work, he's barely made a dent in it. Now, when he does make a little money, he makes a payment. If there's any left over, it goes to his family.
And well, sometimes I'm left with nothing.
Javier's married, and he has 4 kids. He says he came to the U.S. to earn money to repair his house back in Guatemala. But his plan to make quick cash is not panned out, and he says he's beginning to wonder if a new roof and better walls are worth the years away from his family.
There are some days I can't sleep. I'm tossing and turning in bed with the stress that I get from thinking about this, about the debt, about my family. And the truth is, sometimes I am in total despair. If I did not pay the money, they said that they were going to kidnap one of my children.
There's a massive, massive demographic of mainly Guatemalan males that are here that are in a form of debt bondage.
Ruben Nuno works for the Salvation Army. Part of his job includes helping migrants with food and clothing. He says Javier has reason to be afraid. Nuno just met another guy with a loan like Javier's, who says a lender threatened his family with machetes when he missed his payment.
Yeah, he's in a bad situation. The trafficker called him yesterday and says, you owe me 82,000 quetzales, which is probably around, maybe I'd say $9,000. He says, you owe me $9,000 in interest. I'm going to kill your family.
Ruben says these Guatemalans are mostly indigenous Mayan Indians at the bottom of the economic ladder.
I mean, I think the unfortunate thing is a lot of these guys are preyed upon by individuals who realize that they don't know how to read and write and work well with numbers. You know, these guys are farmers. You know, they know how to work with the land. They know how to work with the hammer. And this may be what a lot of debt bondage in America looks like.
Back on the street corner, Javier says he's had a bit of luck lately.
Okay, vamos.
Javier just got a job working on a 5-man crew doing a remodeling project in Beverly Hills. This morning, he's hanging from scaffolding, applying beige stucco to a sprawling 3-bedroom house perched above palm-lined streets. Although things are looking up, Javier still worries.
I don't know if there's going to be more work to do or not. My boss hasn't said anything. So this week we finished this project and I don't know if there's going to be more or not.
He knows what can happen when you get too far behind with loan payments. Recently, another worker gave up and went home because he couldn't find work.
He lost his house. He even started crying and telling me that he was going back because the man that loaned him the money was taking his wife out of the house. And he said, I've got to get back because I need to see what I'm going to do with my family.
Javier says he worries his friend might be homeless or dead because he didn't pay off his debt. But as he starts stuccoing a new section of the house, he tells me, if he had to do it all over again, he would still cross the border for work.
I plan to stay 2 more years to pay the debt and save some extra money to remodel my house. Because that's why I came here, to make a better future for my children.
His children and his family, that's what keeps him going. For the World Vision Report, I'm Daisha Eaton in Los Angeles.
There are almost 800,000 Guatemalans in the U.S. Half of them are here illegally. Last year, the Guatemalan embassy in L.A. started a program to help the illegal workers return to Guatemala. The embassy supplied papers and a free bus ticket, but no solution to their debt problem. So far, only about 50 men have gone back to Guatemala through the program. Day laborers in the Philippines are turning to a TV show as a way to solve their money problems. The popular game show is called Wow Wowee. It features contestants like street vendors, garbage collectors, and other low-wage workers who are struggling to make ends meet. They compete for large sums of money by describing the extreme hardship they're facing. The best story, often the most heartbreaking, wins the contest. Simone Orendine followed one contestant and filed this report.
Jojo Kadungag works as a jeepney driver. That's an open-air minibus used for public transit. But his had been broken down for weeks, and he didn't have the money to fix it. Things got so bad for the 40-year-old and his family, they were eating one meal a day of rice porridge for a week straight. Kadungag says his lowest point was when he bought an ice cream that cost about 11 cents.
Naalala ko yung pamilya ko. Para akong maiyak. Masarap ng kinain ko.
When I thought about my family and my wife and my kids, I wanted to cry. They had no food, no lunch. But Mia had this delicious ice cream. I couldn't just waste it, so I had to finish it. But when I got home, I had to ask for forgiveness.
That week, in his squatter's home, Kadungag was watching TV and saw a call for jeepney drivers to try out for the game show Wow Wow Wee. This daily lunchtime show is wildly popular here. 6 contestants compete for about $22,000 in prize money by first sharing a story about their financial struggles and then going head-to-head in a music trivia game. Wow Wow Wee always looks for players who are facing extreme hardship. They must be engaging and tell a compelling story about their struggle to the show's hosts. Kadungag made the final cut, maybe because he not only supports his own 3 kids, but also the family of his unemployed brother. Just for being chosen, he received about $110. During the show, the hosts joke about Kadungag's flowing black curls and trimmed goatee, calling him an action movie star. Kadungag tells them he hasn't worked for a month. His jeepney broke down for the 4th time in 5 years, he says. I owe so much money on it that no one will loan me more for the latest fix. His wife, Agnes, takes the mic and reminds him that his family loves him very much. To lighten the mood, Wow Wow Wee asks contestants to show off a talent. Kadungag chooses to serenade his wife. For this and his hard luck anecdote, the hosts give Kadungog the equivalent of about $220. Then he beats the other players in several rounds of a Name That Tune game. The show's producers add more to his winnings, and Kadungog now has a total of about $540. For making it this far, Kadungog gets a shot at serious money in the very last game. A model carries in a stack of cash and hands some of it to Kadungog. He must decide whether to trade in this new pile of cash for one of 10 boxes in front of him. Any one of them could hold the coveted grand prize, 1 million pesos. That's $22,000. The audience, along with all four hosts, scream, "Cash or bukas! Open the lid!" as the model keeps piling on the cash. The final offer reaches 50,000 pesos, about $1,100. Kadungog's wife, Agnes, insists he take the cash, but even with a mic, she's barely audible above the din of frantic voices. Some critics say the show and antics like this take advantage of folks who are down and out. Longtime Wow Wow Wee host Mariel Rodriguez says the show's not out to exploit anyone.
Some people think that way too, because we squeeze it out from them, the hardships in life. But I think they've managed to accept the show for what it is. I mean, it's been here for 5 years, and basically by now, I hope they understand all we really want to do is help and make people happy.
Back on the set, Kadungog has decided to keep the additional money and give up the chance for the big prize of 1 million pesos. He yells out, "Cash!" Kadungog walks away with about $1,600. Afterward, he says he'll use the money to fix his jeepney. The rest will go towards food and school uniforms. Kadungog's happy with the outcome.
Hindi ko inisip na manalo ng ganito ang inano ko na.
I didn't think I'd win this way. I just thought God will take care of me. And by the grace of God, I achieved what I really wanted to happen.
And as for being exploited, Kadungog says he doesn't feel that way at all. And what happened to him was, in his words, a beautiful thing. For the World Vision Report, I'm Simone Orendain in Manila.
Every 5 seconds, somewhere in the world, a child dies from
and
hunger.
So what we are seeing is in places where people were not desperate before.
The number of hungry people
more
worldwide
people hungry,
has reached 1 billion.
Chronic world hunger, the problem can seem insurmountable. But a city in Brazil has actually found a solution for its hunger crisis. We'll hear more about it next on the World Vision Report. Welcome back to the World Vision Report. I'm Peggy Waymire. In the developing world, hunger is a chronic problem. That's why a lot of eyes are on Belo Horizonte, a large city in Brazil, which has dramatically reduced hunger and malnutrition. Michael Jahi Chappelle from Cornell University has studied the anti-hunger program there. He says the key to the program has been to focus on food security.
The thing about hunger is you can stop hunger with calories. Hunger can be stopped with McDonald's. Food security has to be stopped with a comprehensive program that gives people access to the assortment of food that they have the right to. With Belo Horizonte, they called it food with dignity.
So their philosophy was that it was a basic human right to have food, good food.
Yes, exactly. I mean, in the Universal Declaration of Human Rights from the founding of the UN and another treaty in the 1970s reaffirmed that right. And most countries have signed on to it, including the United States, though it was never ratified by Congress. So Belo Horizonte said, this is a right that's internationally recognized, and we want to take it seriously.
Jahi Chappelle says an important part of the program is to get enriched, nutritious foods to people in need, like the elderly, children, and pregnant women. But there's another way they're tackling hunger in Belo Horizonte, by helping farmers sell their food directly to consumers without a middleman.
So the primary program there is called Direct from the Countryside. They have 20 to 60 farmers each year who participate in this. And they have city spaces that the city owns, and they've put up farm stands there and rent them to local farmers at highly subsidized and low prices. And research had found that retailers, produce stores, had a 1 to 200% markup.
Really? Is that because of the middlemen?
Exactly.
How many people are these farmers feeding in the city?
I'm trying to remember the exact numbers, but I believe that they estimated around 120,000, 150,000 families took advantage of this program, patronized the farmers market each year.
I understand the government has also subsidized restaurants around the city where people can go in and dine for very, very low prices. Can you tell us a little about that?
Sure. They're called popular restaurants or the people's restaurants. And so they have, right now, I think three major cafeterias and then some smaller sort of stands in some sort of like construction sites, you know, working class neighborhoods. And it's a price-controlled cafeteria, so everything is one real, which is the Brazilian currency. Right now, that's about 65 cents. So for one real, you get a 1,000-calorie lunch, more or less, that has rice and beans, some kind of fruit and vegetable, and meat or a meat substitute. It's open to everyone. They serve about 15,000 people a day at those three major restaurants. It probably is more than that now. They've been expanding since I was last there. The food is always cooked fresh on site, designed by nutritionists and chefs to be really tasty as well as really healthy.
So have you eaten in one of these cafeterias?
Oh, yeah. Every time I go down there.
Walk through one of them with us. What kind of people are there? What kind of mix? How's the food taste?
They're really great, especially the new one they opened, which is right in a part of downtown where there's a lot of businesses. The new one is a really beautiful space. They've got a little lobby, and there's people who play music there sometimes, live music. The line goes all the way around the block because the food is really great and really cheap. Most of the patrons tend to be low income or very low income. The studies said about 85%. But it also said people all the way to the highest income classes ate there to some extent as well. So you get doctors and lawyers. You definitely get a lot of college students. But at the low price, you see street children there that maybe spend a couple minutes begging and are able to get one real and get in line and get this this meal. One of the other things for this program with the idea of food with dignity is that it shouldn't feel like a handout. It should feel like, I mean, you've paid for it, and that's part of the concept. Everyone pays for their lunch, so you've paid for it. You should get a high-quality lunch. And so they don't have any plastic forks or styrofoam cups or disposable stuff. They're these stainless steel trays, real silverware, everything like that. You go and you're served by the lunch staff there, and it's, you know, fresh, piping hot. I don't know. It's a pretty festive atmosphere. It's sort of like a cafeteria, I guess, way back in elementary school. You just sort of a little bit of everyone there. It's a really fun place to eat.
The big question here, the elephant in the room, seems to be, okay, you get enriched flour for free, you get subsidized vegetables at markets, you get to go to these cool cafeterias where music's playing and eat lunch for next to nothing. Who is paying for this?
Well, that's the beauty of the programs. I mean, in the programs that are subsidized, because it's only paying for part of the cost, just to make the cost more accessible, it's not a huge city expenditure. And so overall, it costs the city about 1.5% of their annual budget. Back in the late 90s, that was about $18 million. I don't know what it is these days, but it's always been less than 2% of the city budget over the years. But, I mean, we have subsidized school programs here in the United States as well. So it really is very, very affordable to the city.
Is there a contingent of critics who say that this is too much government subsidizing or too much government intervention or not? Is everybody pretty much on board with this?
I would say, you know, in a way, that's a very American question.
Mm-hmm.
Certainly in Brazil, that question doesn't usually come up. I mean, one of the things about Brazil is there's a basic assumption that government should be there to help people and should be there to make sure that the market and society works so that everyone has basic rights like the right to food.
And has there been much follow-up research done on how effective the program really has been at covering the needs of the poor when it comes to food security?
There has. It's not as consistent as I would like, and that continues to be a problem in the city and Brazil at large is a lack of really large-scale and regular follow-up and evaluation. But if you look at the numbers we do have, we know over the first 10 to 15 years of the program, infant malnutrition and infant mortality dropped by about 50%.
Does the government plan to continue this program? Does it feel as though it's working?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, and with those results, with infant malnutrition having dropped by 50, 60%, they've gotten international awards consistently. People come from around the world to study it. Yeah, I mean, not as often as I would like. I mean, actually, I think the story of Belo Horizonte is not nearly as well known as it should be.
I understand that the original local government leaders who first implemented this in Belo Horizonte are now working on a zero hunger program for the rest of Brazil. How is that going, nationalizing the program?
Really well. So actually, the Brazilian president, Lula, came into office running on a zero hunger platform. And the federal minister in charge of their office of fighting hunger, basically, was the mayor that started this program in Belo Horizonte. And so you've seen dramatic reductions in children underweight and infant malnutrition. it seems to be working very, very well on the national level. Indeed, a friend of mine who's a historian said that this is probably one of the great reductions in hunger and poverty ever seen in history.
Michael Jahi-Chappell is a postdoctoral associate at Cornell University. Jahi, thank you so much for joining us today.
It's my pleasure.
Brazil lost one of its favorite musicians a few weeks ago. Paulo Moura was one of Brazil's best-loved instrumentalists. He was one of 10 children in the Moura family. His father, who was also a musician, urged Paulo to get a secure job and become a tailor. But music was Moura's passion. When he was just a young boy, he joined his father and his older siblings, entertaining the local black community in their small hometown. Moura eventually moved to Rio, where he became a master on the clarinet and the saxophone. He broke racial barriers in Brazil by becoming the first black member of the Municipal Theater Orchestra. Moura was famous for his versatility. He played jazz, folk, and classical music. And in 2000, he won a Latin Grammy for Best Brazilian Roots Album. Here's a track from his latest album, Afro Bossa Nova. It's called Falando de Amor. In Sudan, 20 years of civil war between the Arab Muslim North and the Christian African South has left 2 million dead. Both sides used child soldiers. A peace agreement was signed in 2005 to end the war. Part of that agreement said that child soldiers had to be sent home. That would seem to be a good thing. But returning child soldiers are finding they're not always welcomed home in the ways they'd imagined. Zach Badorf introduces us to one child who served in Southern Sudan's military. His name and the names of his family members have been changed to protect his identity.
16-year-old Richard sits silently on a small plastic chair in a mud hut church as people around him sing in God's name. He's quiet and reserved, wearing his Sunday best, a red shirt with brown slacks and brown leather shoes. After the service, he makes the 5-minute walk back to his home, passing by two young girls, each cradling a baby and singing lullabies. This peaceful village is a stark contrast to life lived by this former soldier.
It was very bad for me to be in the military when I was 12 and 13 years old, but there was no other option, because if I wanted to escape, those people would have looked for me.
Richard has a constant look of sadness in his eyes. He was 11 when soldiers from the Sudan People's Liberation Army, or SPLA, forced him into the military. They were fighting against the northern Sudanese military for the south's independence.
When the SPLA came to us, the older people ran away. I didn't run because I was a child, so they captured me. When I refused to come to the barracks, they kept beating me. I didn't want to go, but they forced me.
Eventually, he was trained on how to use a gun. He was given his own AK-47 assault rifle and was sent to the front lines to battle the Messiria, a tribe of Arab nomads who bring their cattle to graze on land in southern Sudan. Richard claims he shot at them, but never killed anyone. Richard was forced into the military shortly before a peace treaty was signed requiring that all children be demobilized. But it took about 5 years for southern Sudanese government officials to show up in Richard's barracks. He thought they were lying when they said they were going to take him out of the military. But it was no hoax. He went to live with his uncle here in this town since both his parents had died. Using a wooden mallet, Richard's cousin slowly mashes sorghum into ugali, an East African staple for the poor that resembles porridge. Richard says it took a little while to adjust to civilian life. At first, he used to march around and stomp his feet like he was back in the army. Other children would run away from him.
It was very difficult for me to play with other kids, because the other children were really afraid of me. They actually isolated me, so it was difficult.
But over the past 2 months since he came here, things have improved. Now Richard plays soccer with his friends every afternoon.
I found it very nice to be home because I found some friends here. And also my family told me they miss me a lot. So now, if they tell me to go back to the army, I will refuse.
For some children, the reintegration is not so easy. The biggest problem is getting fed. A food crisis in the region means many families don't have enough food as is. Bismarck Swangen is UNICEF's communications officer in southern Sudan. Swangen recalls what happened to one demobilized child who was used to getting regular meals in the army.
When a follow-up was done after some time, one of the parents said, you know, thank you for bringing our children, but I can tell you that these are not our children. Because the child went home and he was expecting to have breakfast, he was expecting to have lunch, he was expecting to have dinner, he was expecting to have biscuit and milk at some stage. These are things which are never at home.
The South Sudan government admits that some children are actually returning to the military because there's not enough food for them at home. When Richard's uncle William agreed to take him in, he did receive a 3-month supply of food from the World Food Program. Richard himself got some clothes and a soccer ball. William breaks open a patch of ground outside his home. He'll plant maize to feed his family. He thought his nephew had been killed in the war and was pleased to welcome him into his home. William says it's very bad for children to be in the army.
When these children came back to the family, they still had that military attitude. They behaved like military guys. Sometimes when you talk to them, they don't listen.
But William says his nephew has adjusted well to civilian life and behaves, as he put it, like a normal citizen now. William is making sure Richard gets an education, paying annual school fees of about $50. That's a small fortune here.
Because after they complete their education, they will be able to feed themselves on their own. That's why I sent him to school.
Richard is in sixth grade now and says he wants to become a doctor so he can serve his community. But he has another goal, too.
What I dream for, if I finish my studies, is to become president like Omar al-Bashir.
But unlike Bashir, who seized power in a 1989 military coup, Richard has had enough of the military. For the World Vision Report, I'm Zach Badorf in southern Sudan.
You can read Zach's blog on our website, worldvisionreport.org. The group Action Against Hunger has come up with a simple solution to deal with malnutrition. Many of the children they work with in the huge Dadaab refugee camp in Kenya are malnourished, in spite of all the food aid coming into the camp. That's because the rations consist of only basic food stuff, like beans, sugar, and maize. There's not a green vegetable in sight, so the kids don't get vitamin A, E, or iron, all of which they need to stay healthy. But that's changing now because of this new program. Silke Peach from Action Against Hunger joins me now to explain.
The refugee camps, you have to imagine like a little town. So you have little marketplaces within those camps, which are providing lots of basic essentials like soap or matches or cigarettes. There's some food products and there's some fresh food. Not much at the beginning of the program, for instance, there was very, very little supply of fresh foods. But outside of the Dadaab camps, there's a town which is called Dadaab Town. And they have a much bigger market where a lot of fresh foods is as well available.
So the food's outside the camp, but the farmers don't want to go to the effort to bring it in because the refugees don't have any purchasing power.
Exactly. So the solution we found to facilitate basically the link was to provide those families with malnourished children with a food voucher, with a fresh food voucher. It's like a food ticket or a food token, for instance. So those families received them through the nutrition program, which is on the ground for the treatment, direct treatment of those very malnourished children. And then those caretakers or mothers would be able to go to the local markets in the camps and exchange those vouchers with traders which were contracted for the program to provide fruits and vegetables, for instance, and milk and eggs.
This sounds like a no-brainer.
Yeah, it's very straightforward. It's like monopoly money facilitating the access or the ability for the family to access exactly those fresh foods which they need. It's very simple.
How many children are now getting fed through these vouchers?
Until earlier this year, we had about 65,000 children in the year and a half before that date the program was running.
And how is it working?
It's working excellently. I mean, linked to those vouchers, we have education sessions on nutrition, on hygiene, on food preparation. We have cooking sessions with those mothers. We had a couple of families and husbands coming to the program to receive the vouchers. And they were telling us they have arguments at home of who should be going to these sessions because everybody's so interested in them.
You mean even the men want to come?
Yeah. The husbands wanted to come and learn. So it was a whole kind of community action in those camps. And everybody loves it. The community is very, very happy. We see an impact on the health and the nutritional status of the children.
Tell me about the impact. What's happened to the children as a result of having access to this fresh food through the vouchers?
What basically happens is that through a diversified diet, their nutritional status is much improved. They're not as easily getting sick, and hence they don't need to come back to that nutrition program all the time. So they're much more lively. They're less a burden for the whole family as well. They're better able to go to school and follow education as well. So the whole family is much better off.
Silke Peach is with Action Against Hunger. Silke, thank you so much for joining us today.
You're most welcome, Peggy.
The food voucher program in the Dadaab camp is funded by the French Embassy in Nairobi. Coming up, enriching the minds of children, one small laptop at a time.
Pero es increíble porque vos fíjate que antes acá no hay ni biblioteca en este barrio.
It's incredible. Look, there's no library in this neighborhood, and now we can access a library with one click.
That story next on the World Vision Report. Stay with us.
Ikone mande alakison shini kene yalla ina na na Ikone mama sa alakane kisi labanku juya mawimba Ikone ma alakane ke fendi bayi ainya Ainya, ainya,
neba neba, iye puma mi fonya na mi miri jenara, neba neba.
I'm Peggy Waymire with the World Vision Report. One laptop per child. That's the goal of the nonprofit group working to put laptops into the hands of kids all across the developing world. The idea is catching on in countries from Ethiopia to Uruguay. In fact, that tiny Latin American nation has just completed a program to hand out low-cost laptops to every child enrolled in school. Reporter Annie Murphy has the story.
Outside the local elementary school in Montevideo's La Paloma neighborhood, children in white and navy blue uniforms play on swing sets or laugh with friends. It's a typical scene, except for one detail. The kids are all carrying small, white cases with neon green handles. They're EXO laptops, small, no-frills computers that do basics like surfing the internet and word processing. And every elementary school student in Uruguay has one, thanks to a program funded by the government. The project is called Plan Sabal. The Spanish acronym stands for Educational Connection to Basic Information for Online Learning. In this sixth grade class, students are researching Renaissance art on the internet.
Bajar información. Buscar fotos y pinturas y todo eso.
Jessica Hernandez says she's been busy downloading facts and searching for photos and paintings. Her teacher, Alicia Lopez, says the computers have had a huge impact in classroom learning.
Pero es increíble porque vos fíjate que antes acá no hay ni biblioteca en este barrio.
It's incredible. Look, there's no library in this neighborhood. And now we can access a library with one click. It was an incredible change.
Before class, 12-year-old Enzo Jacinto and his mother sat in the town plaza next to a squeaky swing set. There's free Wi-Fi here, and they were using the internet together. Enzo, a slight boy who wears a soccer jersey and an earring in one ear, says he used to have a hard time in school.
Before, I didn't even feel like playing. I didn't want to do anything. But now that we have the computers, I do. For example, sometimes a teacher has us doing mapping exercises. When the earthquakes hit, we use laptops to make maps of Haiti and Chile. with information we found on the computer. I could see all this information, and my father also showed me some videos from Haiti that he found on the internet.
A government study to measure the effect of the laptops on learning is underway. But teacher Alicia Lopez believes it's already clear the laptops have made a crucial difference for students like Enzo.
For example, when his classmates are analyzing a poem, Enzo might be writing 4 or 5 lines about the poem on his laptop, an activity that he had a hard time doing in his notebook.
Enzo lives a few blocks away, down a dirt path. It's a small, bare house with no front door. Roosters hover in the yard, and inside, Enzo's mother, Mary Vieira, is watching 2 of her 6 children. She, too, has noticed a huge change in her son.
Sí, ahora está adelantando mucho. Era antes era no te puedo, insoportable.
She says that Enzo's making a lot of progress. Before, he used to be impossible, but now, when he has a bad moment, he just picks up the laptop and says, "Okay, I'm going to go download something," and walks through the town plaza to get on the net.
We're
humble people, but now sometimes Enzo says to me, "Will you send me somewhere to study computers?" I hope that there will be a way for him to keep studying, and that sooner or later he will go somewhere in life. I like that he's using the computer, and I want him to stick with it.
Enzo's 6-year-old sister, Milagro, is eager to start school and to get her own laptop. While I spoke to her mother, Milagro pulled out the laptop her older sister had left at home that day and booted it up at the kitchen table. Milagro says, "I adore the laptop because it has a lot to do, a lot of games." And it turns out her brother Enzo often falls asleep with his computer tucked beside him under the covers. For the World Vision Report, I'm Annie Murphy in Montevideo, Uruguay.
The small green Exo laptops are being put to good use in Rwanda as well. Here's Rwandan journalist Pridon Sanyumva with this week's Globe at a Glance.
In an elementary school just outside Kigali, every child has a small green laptop. That's thanks to an American non-profit organization called One Laptop Per Child. A few months ago, one of the teachers at the school gave her class an assignment, research how to prevent malaria. Malaria is the leading killer in Rwanda, particularly for children under 5 years old. Some people believe you can get the disease by eating sugarcane or by being rained on. To do their research, many of the students walked to the airport so they could use the free wireless connection there. Then they produced short cartoons on the computer about the subject. The cartoons showed how bed nets and cutting back trees could help prevent malaria. The kids took their laptops home and showed the cartoons to their families, friends, and neighbors. Teacher Françoise Murekeisoni says the funny animations have been very effective in getting people to take action against mosquitoes. And that's this week's Globe at a Glance. I am Pridon Sengyumva in Kigali, Rwanda.
There were no laptops in Kaskikote when Mahesh Tripathi was growing up. Who knows what he would have done with it if he'd had one. Mahesh grew up in a small farming village in Nepal, but he was less interested in farming than in figuring out how things worked. So he started building things, things the villagers had never seen before. Like, well, we'll let reporter Laura Sparrow tell you the story.
I met Mahesh Tripathi 4 years ago, just before he started 11th grade at Pokhara Engineering College. In a place where I'm a head taller than everyone, he's my height, with a blasé mop of black hair, like Harry Potter.
A long time ago, there was electricity in my village, but nothing else. There was a radio. That was the latest electronics equipment. At a pond near my house, we used to play with the boats by hand. And I thought, how could a machine run a boat on water?
So he made a small boat out of discarded plastic, and
I told my dad to go find me a small motor in the city. When I was 5 or 6, I attached it to the little boat, and I tested it out on the pond. Everyone came to watch.
It was this boat that first got Mahesh thinking about how to build a human-like robot.
I thought, if you design any mechanism and fix a motor to it, you can achieve any kind of function. I thought and thought about it. How does a hand work? How does a face work?
Let's just review this for a second. You're six. You're in this village, sitting in your house across from the lake, and your parents are listening to politics on Radio Nepal, which is your only connection to the rest of the world. You've discovered this thing called a motor, and you're thinking about how to build robots. And after a bit of tinkering around and sending Dad on a dozen day-long hiking trips to the city to look for this or that, you get some wood and scraps to build
an arm. There was nothing else, just an arm.
And when you attach a motor to it, it moves like an arm. It took Mahesh until he was 14 to build a human-like robot with a smiling cardboard face and motorized arms. The humanoid used cassette tape technology to answer questions like, "What is your name? How are you?" But the humanoid doesn't exist anymore. Like most of Mahesh's creations, it was taken apart so that its components could be reused for another experiment. Last summer, he made a generator out of magnets and used it to light a bulb and turn a fan. In a country that sees up to 16 hours a day of power outages, that creation earned him an invitation to meet the president of Nepal. But it's unclear what Mahesh is going to do with his talents. Nepal has no cutting-edge research facilities, and top academics all leave the country. And it's not like Mahesh's parents have the money to send him abroad, or even enough education of their own to offer him guidance. Then again, let's be honest. In the world of robotics, all of Mahesh's inventions are rudimentary. That's not what's surprising. What's surprising is the way the human mind can look at one thing and see something that isn't there yet. How a little boy can look at a boat and wonder about a robot.
Laura Sparrow is a freelance reporter based in New York. She's been visiting Kaska Coat since 2002. And Mahesh Tripathi? He's 20 years old now, and he wants to be an engineer. He says he knows about 25 other aspiring inventors like himself in Nepal. Mahesh is currently working on a larger version of his magnetic generator. From one group of young people fast-forwarding into the future to another who are trying to preserve the past. The Marasi are a group of untouchables, the lowest caste in India. They've been singing and playing music for the past 2,000 years. The songs are mystical and mesmerizing, and they're in danger of dying out. Now there's an effort to keep them alive against all odds. In this commentary, independent producer Adam Pogoff takes us to the Jaisalmer district of Rajasthan.
Every day at around 2 in the afternoon, you can hear a vocal warm-up through the second floor windows of a small sandstone school building. To get upstairs, you have to walk over an open sewer and through the neon orange door. I kicked off my brown camel leather sandals outside the school door and walk onto the cold gray stone floors. A dozen ancient string instruments hang from a bright pink wall. They look like bloated, crude versions of violins with three times as many strings. They are hung in chronological order. The youngest is 1,000 years old. In one of the classrooms, some girls lean against the peach walls singing. A few of the boys are sitting on the floor, casually beating out rhythms on cylindrical drums. All these children are Marasi, a subgroup of untouchables who have traditionally played music for upper caste patrons for the past 2,000 years. They also sing Muslim and Hindu mystic songs that are a cocktail of complex rhythms and powerful vocal melodies. This school exists to ensure that their ancient music never dies. Hearing this music performed live has been on my list of things to do before I die ever since high school. That's when I discovered a CD in my school library. The album cover was irresistible. It had a photo of an old man wearing a pink and yellow Technicolor turban. The exotic music opened my ears to a rich musical tradition I couldn't have imagined.
Well, we have like 3,000 songs. songs about, you know, like water, fire, festivals, marriage or death or birth.
That's Sarwar Khan, master musician and co-founder of this music school. Khan opened it just a few years ago. The 50 or so students here come from remote desert villages up to 60 miles away to learn subjects including math, Hindi and English, and take lessons from master musicians.
My father told me, I tell my children, he tell his children, so all 38 generations learned by that way.
38 generations. That's an oral tradition reaching back 2,000 years. Upper caste members are now playing recorded music at their weddings and celebrations instead of employing Marasi. Every celebration with a boombox means more jobs lost. Khan's music classes train kids for the few remaining jobs playing at celebrations. And, with the help of a New York nonprofit called Folk Arts Rajasthan, Khan has developed a plan to get kids more paying jobs. The most talented students are selected to play at the embassy schools in Delhi. Khan hopes those embassies will help organize even better paying international tours of these talented musicians.
Our old traditional way of singing and songs and our instrument get lost because many they add Western music inside.
That's Khan's way of saying Western music influences are creeping into Marasi music and ruining their oral folk tradition. Now you can even find non-native instruments like the bagpipe and trumpet in celebratory music. But here in this school, students hone their skills on traditional Marasi instruments, like castanets. Students run to a basket overflowing with them. Unlike Spanish castanets that are round, these instruments are polished wooden sticks that look like melted dark chocolate bars. The kids sit on the floor waiting for the teacher's instructions with rapt attention. When the teacher says, play, they spring to life, throwing one hand over their head and the other curled out in front of their torso. Their hands flutter in tight circles, pulling the castanets out from their bodies and then snapping them back as the rhythms change. Scanning the 24 pairs of big brown eyes sitting around me, I remember that moment 10 years ago, back in high school, when I first heard this music. But I wondered if I was looking at the last generation of Marasi musicians. Would their music turn into a museum piece, just like the wooden instruments hanging on the school walls? Over the centuries, the dry desert air has protected those instruments. Hopefully, this school will do the same thing for Marasi music itself.
Adam Pogoff is an independent producer based in Brooklyn. Adam thought we'd like to hear how a Marasi master plays this music. So he sent us this recording of Jalal Khan. Khan has performed in some of the world's greatest concert halls, but here he performs a Hindu mystic song in a one-room cinder block home. It was basically a private performance for Adam and a few friends. Khan is singing and playing the harmonium as three musicians join him on the drums, castanets, and vocals. Adam tells us it was about 110 degrees and a ceiling fan spun above the musicians. It's common for musicians to give tourists private concerts in hotels and restaurants, but it's very rare for a Westerner to have a private concert off the tourist track. Adam says he was thrilled to hear and record these master musicians in such an intimate space. Quite an ending to the story of a young high school boy who once dreamed of hearing Marasi music live. You can see a slideshow of the Marasi master playing music. It's on our website, worldvisionreport.org. And with that, we come to the end of our show this week. The show is produced by Beverly Abel and edited by Diane Toomey. Lita Hartman is the assignment editor. Christina Darden, Cynthia Graber, and Sue Shepherd are our producers. Doug Boyles is our audio engineer. Emily Eagle is the engineering assistant. Chris Baldiga is the production assistant. And I'm Peggy Wehmeyer. Thanks for listening.
Support for this program comes from World Vision, building a better world for children. The views expressed on this show are not necessarily those of the organization.